content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Smithsonian. Smithsonian is generously supported by the Kepin family. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. On today's program, we'll start by finishing the article we began last week titled Plunder at the Pink Temple by Joshua Hammer. A young French couple, a sacred shrine and a century-old crime that helped ignite the unfinished battle to reclaim Cambodia's looted antiquities. At this point in the article, we are learning about André Malraux and his wife, who led an expedition to steal portions of the temple. He was convicted and served a brief sentence in prison, but at this point, he does not feel like he did anything wrong. And we'll begin a little bit earlier than where we left off. Malraux would never apologize for what he had done. Yet, the enforced sojourn in Phnom Penh, and later in Saigon, while awaiting his appeal, seemed to shake him out of his apolitical self-absorption. Genevieve says, that's his biographer. Malraux had spent months observing the French colonial system's underbelly, the theft of antiquities by corrupt officials, the casual racism and cruelty, heavy-handed attempts to stifle anti-French protests in the press. Only months after his return to France in late 1924, he and Clara traveled back to Saigon, where he founded a pro-independence newspaper called L'Indochine and joined the young Annam movement, which opposed the French presence in the region. Malraux moved from political indifference to political commitment, wrote the French scholar Raoul Genar in How Malraux Became Malraux, published in 2015. The leader of Cambodia's patrimony had morphed into an agitator for the anti-colonial cause. Vietnam also served as a jumping-off point for Malraux's next adventures. In 1925, on a trip to Hong Kong to buy linotype for his newspaper, which was later squeezed out of business by French authorities, he took an excursion up the Pearl River to Canton. Clashes were breaking out between the communist workers and the right-wing Kuomintang government, led by Chiang Kai-shek. In 1928, Malraux published The Conquerors, a novel about the Canton uprising, and it gave the author what he had long craved, recognition as a major literary voice. In Man's Fate, his masterpiece, published 5 years later, Malraux chronicled the heroics of a failed communist uprising in Shanghai and a massacre of sympathizers by the Kuomintang. All that men are willing to die for beyond self-interest tends to justify that fate by giving it a foundation and dignity, he wrote. Malraux regarded communism as a powerful force against injustice, and he romanticized armed struggle. It was, some observed, as if he needed to redeem himself after the courts had branded him a criminal. Malraux's conviction, wrote the American literary critic Roger Shattuck in 1968, had a traumatic effect, forcing Malraux to square off with the dark angel of his own past. Malraux continued to redefine himself as a foe of authoritarianism and voice of the oppressed. When civil war broke out in Spain in July 1936, he used his rising influence to secure French aircraft on behalf of the Republicans, then organized air crews and accompanied them on operations. He joined the French resistance in 1944, taking part in the harassment of an SS division as it moved north to join the battle for Normandy. In July of that year, he was wounded and captured, then was left behind in a Toulouse prison camp when the Germans retreated. Malraux met Charles de Gaulle at the end of the war and was captivated by the general, regarding him as another self-made and charismatic man of action. The admiration was mutual. Later, when de Gaulle became president, he looked into Malraux's background and saw the crime in Cambodia as no impediment to his appointment as France's first Minister of Cultural Affairs in 1959, Genevieve says. He was widely regarded as an ambitious and effective minister, renovating much of the country's deteriorating state architecture, democratizing the arts by opening Maisons de la Culture, state-funded cultural centers in many provincial cities, and revitalizing the Louvre, the Comédie Française, and other great institutions. Monroe moved easily in circles of power. He formed a close attachment to the Kennedys, escorted the First Lady during trips to Paris, and visited her in the United States after her husband's assassination. He made a memorable state trip to China in 1965, where he was feted by Premier Zhou Enlai with Chairman Mao Zedong for several hours. Monroe came away impressed by Mao's mastery of global affairs. And before Nixon's groundbreaking trip to China 7 years later, the president conferred with Monroe in the White House about Mao's character and mindset. One of the few places Monroe found himself unwelcome was Cambodia. A planned visit with de Gaulle in 1968 had to be aborted after George Grosselier's son, Bernard Philippe, then the conservator of Angkor, threatened to quit in protest. Despite his accomplishments, Monroe remained something of the hustler and prevaricator of his youth. He had an endless capacity for self-mythologizing. In the introduction to the first edition of Man's Fate, he claimed falsely that he had served on a 12-man revolutionary committee in Canton in 1924 and participated in hand-to-hand fighting. In his biography, Todd wrote that Monroe exaggerated his relationship with Mao, as well as his heroics during World War II, and many even have made off with resistance funds after the Nazi surrender. By then, he was separated from Clara, who survived World War II in hiding, and later carved out a successful career as a novelist and memorialist. She died in 1982. Half a century after André Malraux's death in 1976, the Cambodian misadventure divides opinion about him. Was he a con man and scoundrel? A renegade romantic? Many Cambodians still view him as epitomizing the greed and arrogance of the colonial system. Yu Chang, the founding director of the Documentation Center of Cambodia in Phnom Penh, which records Cambodia's turbulent recent history, says Malraux's lack of contrition and rise to the top of the French establishment sent the message from the country's former colonizer that Cambodia still belongs to us. Nor did the theft of Cambodian antiquities end with Malraux, far from it. Artifacts were misappropriated throughout the French colonial period, which ended in 1954. The murderous Khmer Rouge regime officially prohibited the destruction of temples, but cadres often trafficked in antiquities to finance their activities. After the regime fell in 1979, lawlessness and civil strife engulfed the country, and looting continued without restraint for 20 or more years. Last year, the Smithsonian's National Museum of Asian Art returned three Khmer sculptures to Cambodia after determining they were likely looted during the 1960s or 70s. In 2019, prosecutors in New York indicted Douglas Latchford, a British expat living in Thailand, charging him with using New York bank accounts to facilitate a wide-scale theft and smuggling operation dating to the 1990s. Latchford employed dozens of thieves to chisel off hundreds of sculptures and snatch bronze figurines from Khmer temples. He reportedly earned tens of millions of dollars faking provenances and selling the art to private collectors and Western museums. Latchford died in 2020 before standing trial, and the extent of his crimes is only now coming to light. Malraux's Vanishing Act in 1923 stopped at the border, but Latchford's did not, says Brad Gordon, an American lawyer who's assisting Cambodia in tracking down its lost art. He proudly trafficked Cambodia's treasures into prestigious Western institutions and into the living rooms of billionaires. Genovese, reflecting on what she calls Malraux's juvenile indiscretion, further distinguishes between the crimes, arguing that in Malraux's case, the friezes were returned without lasting damage to Bonte Schrey. "I'm willing to be generous," told Malraux, she says. Today, Bonte Schrey has emerged as one of Cambodia's most popular attractions. Perhaps ironically, its fortunes improved profoundly as a result of Malraux's desecration. In January 1924, Parmentier trekked to the ruins to verify what Malraux had stolen, then oversaw the effort to clear vegetation, inventory artifacts, and translate inscriptions in Sanskrit and Old Khmer. 7 years later, Henri Marchal, the conservator of Angkor, reassembled the toppled temples using both the original stones and modern materials. "I visited the complex late on a July afternoon, arriving at the same moment as a tour group consisting of dozens of Cambodian women wearing identical purple dresses. following the throng down a stone corridor described by Malraux in the Royal Way. I emerged into daylight to see the temples directly in front of me. The three small prasat that Malraux had defaced, intact again, glowed in the setting sun. The smiling goddesses perched on pedestals inside shallow niches. Heads tilted, hair pulled tight beneath elaborate crowns with dangling lotus petal earrings, each wore a sarong and an ornamental sash. Frames around the niches were rich with curving vines, angelic attendants, crowned birds, scrolls, curlicues, and rosettes, all carved from the same reddish-pink sandstone. The 10th century Khmer sculptors had created these devatas with such detailed vibrancy that they seemed ready to leap off the facade. After they carved the eyes and finished the statue, they believed the essence of the god was now incarnated. Olivier Cunin, a French archaeologist who studied the temple for a quarter century, told me in Siem Reap, Malraux had snatched away the deities in an act of avarice and sacrilege. Now the gods were smiling again. Next, we'll move on to an article titled Drafting the Revolution by Noah Lederman. Taverns, public houses, and inns served as unofficial headquarters for the American rebels. Some are still standing, including these 8, where you can raise your glass in the memory of the founders. We held our meetings at the Green Dragon Tavern, Paul Revere wrote in a letter, careful that our meetings should be kept secret. Soon-to-be founding fathers and other patriots, like Revere, found great value in the American public house. It was a place to trade stories, to learn of critical world events, and to strategize. They rallied against British tyranny, plotted protests against loathsome policy, and read aloud from Thomas Paine's Common Sense or from the Declaration of Independence while sipping toddies. At taverns, militias recruited soldiers, held military tribunals, stored military supplies and rations, and hosted patriot groups like the Sons of Liberty. Most taverners supported these gatherings at their establishments because they often felt the crushing British tariffs on raw ingredients for spirits or imprinted goods like playing cards. Revolution would be a boon for business. Today, most colonial-era taverns are gone, but as our country turns 250, a few stalwart pubs remain, holding the hopes and stories of the revolutionary Americans who fought to form a democratic nation. As we celebrate America's independence, consider lifting a foggy beer stein at one of these taverns. Wright Tavern, Concord, Massachusetts. In October 1774, the first Massachusetts Provincial Congress met in Concord. Samuel Adams and John Hancock began the process of separating the 13 colonies from Britain, made plans to redirect the people's taxes from the crown to the provincial Congress, and established the idea that government's power came from the will of the people. During and after the meeting, some reportedly went right next door to Mr. Taylor's Tavern, now Wright Tavern, to celebrate these bold steps by getting sloshed. On April 19, 1775, in the wee hours of the morning, having been warned of approaching redcoats, colonial militiamen gathered at the tavern to plan their maneuvers and then left, ending up on the nearby hills. Later that morning, 700 British regulars rode into Concord to capture the colonists' stockpiled weapons. The Redcoats then commandeered Wright Tavern as their headquarters. Today, a replica of a lion engraving by the colonial artisan Amos Doolittle, hanging just inside the entrance, depicts the British gathering before the tavern. When the Redcoats met the militiamen on the North Bridge, about a mile down the road, both sides fired, resulting in the first casualties for the crown. 6 decades later, Concord native Ralph Waldo Emerson referred to the instigation of that skirmish as the shot heard round the world. By 1793, Wright Tavern had ceased operations, and over the next 2 centuries, the building had dozens of other uses. It was a bakery, a wig manufacturer, and a kindergarten, where 195 kids signed the 1864 Little People's Petition to President Abraham Lincoln, calling for enslaved children to be freed. Today, it is a museum open to the public Fridays through Sundays and also hosts private events. In the fall, tavern service will return so that visitors can enjoy colonial-era drinks like Stone Fences, rum or rye mixed with applejack and hard cider, and Flip, a rum cocktail made with molasses, spices, and a raw egg that was once cooked in a froth with a hot poker from the fireplace. Wright no longer uses the hot poker. Frounce's Tavern, New York City. Many of the original gray-yellow bricks of Frounce's Tavern hold firm with their original 18th-century oyster shell mortar along Broad Street in Lower Manhattan. When Samuel Frounces purchased the tavern in 1762, he marked his establishment with a sign bearing Queen Charlotte's likeness, and the public called it the Queen's Head Tavern. But inside, royalty was despised. During the 1770s, the Sons of Liberty met at Frounces to plot out New York's Tea Party protests. Adams and Hancock visited to devour oysters. And the New York Provincial Congress used Frounces to host meetings and a one court martial, as well as parties, including a barn burner on June 18, 1776. With George Washington in attendance, they made 31 toasts, drank 109 bottles of wine, and paid £91, equal to around $26,000 today, plus 16 additional shillings for broken wine glasses. It was also the site to perhaps the biggest party to celebrate Evacuation Day, November 25, 1783. When the British left New York City after more than 7 years, marking the end of the war and the birth of the nation. That evening, New York's Governor George Clinton gave a public dinner at Frounce's Tavern. General Washington joined in 13 toasts to the new nation, to lost heroes, to America's future as an asylum to the persecuted of the earth, and the hope that this day be a lesson to princes. 9 days later, Frounce's Tavern hosted a more lachrymose occasion. A Patriot spymaster, Benjamin Talmadge, recalled the lamentations that followed Washington as the latter left New York to return to Mount Vernon. "Such a scene of sorrow and weeping I had never witnessed, and fondly hope I may never be called to witness again." Today, visitors to Frounce's Tavern can toast like Washington with a punch cocktail of rum and whiskey, flavored with peach tea and lemon juice, a nod to a time when fresh ingredients were rare. Ye Old Centerton Inn, Pittsgrove, New Jersey. Brian Good and his wife, Joanne, were chefs who had worked at some of New York's most famous restaurants, including Le Bernardin and Jean Georges, respectively. But when the Twin Towers fell in 2001, they sought a new start outside the city and moved to the town of Elmer, in one of the most rural parts of New Jersey, and in 2003 bought Ye Old Centerton Inn in nearby Pittsgrove. Built in 1706, the two-story inn was a stop on the stagecoach route from Bridgeton, New Jersey, to Philadelphia, where travelers came for pints and a bed. Based on an 1803 deed, we can determine that the original 18th-century rooms comprised the bar area, the dining room behind it, and the second story. The inn may have held munitions for the Continental Army. Brian Good recounts the legend that Patriot militiamen once killed two loyalists here and buried their bodies under the fireplace. But there's no way to substantiate things, he laments. Middleton Tavern, Annapolis, Maryland. Traveling from Virginia to Philadelphia was arduous in the 1700s. Meetings of the Continental Congress to the north required Southern delegates to leave their plantations and make the long journey. To trim many hours and miles off the ride, Horatio Middleton's ferry out of Annapolis, Maryland, offered a shortcut across the Chesapeake Bay. While Middleton claimed in an ad in the Maryland Gazette that he keeps the best entertainment as good boats in hands as that any that crossed the bay. Boats crossing the bay weren't so reliable. One ferry carrying George Washington ran aground twice, nearly costing the president his life. Another boat got stuck while ferrying Tench Tillman, one of Washington's aides-de-camp, when he carried surrender documents from British General Charles Cornwallis north to Philadelphia. As a ferry owner, Middleton needed a tavern where customers could gamble and drink while waiting for passage. In 1750, Middleton purchased a sturdy building erected on a stone foundation, with brick walls and oyster shell grout. The construction kept the tavern survive a 1938 hurricane and two fires in the 1970s. In November 1783, Annapolis became the nation's capital for better part of a year, and the tavern would have been busy with associates of Benjamin Franklin, one of whom once requested that debtors meet him at the tavern to make speedy payment. Middleton's bustled with members of the Maryland Jockey Club, the Freemasons, and the Tuesday Club, a social organization comprising the city's self-styled elite, such as Middleton's son, Samuel. According to Tuesday Club records, raucous members visited Middleton's to sing, dance brisk jigs, play music, and drink a good rack punch and claret. Today, guests can eat like colonists, enjoying daily rockfish offerings and oyster shooters served with cocktail sauce, and a Natty Bow beer, a Maryland favorite dating back to the first Cleveland administration. White Horse Tavern, Newport, Rhode Island. Built in 1652, this tavern served in its early days as the meeting place for the Rhode Island colony's General Assembly, as well as the city council and the criminal court. By 1702, William Mays Jr., a notorious pirate who prowled the Indian Ocean, succeeded his father as innkeeper and received a license to sell all sorts of strong drink. 6 years later, the businessman's lunch was supposedly invented there, as councilors began dining at the tavern and charging meals to the public treasury. By 1730, new owners trotted out the tavern's new sign, an image of a white horse. During the war in 1776, the owners left Newport when British troops and loyalist allies turned the White Horse into their accommodations. Today, you won't see much of the rabble at the White Horse. It's now an establishment for Newport's upper crust. Red Fox Inn and Tavern, Middleburg, Virginia. In 1728, using local fieldstone, Joseph Chin built Chin's Ordinary, a tavern in Middleburg, midway between bustling Alexandria and Winchester, on the Ashby Gap trading route. Being dead center gave rise to the town's name, Middleburg, when it was chartered in 1787. George Washington was Chin's cousin, and when the first president rolled through town to visit family, he might have stayed at the inn or at least had a drink there. Chin's Ordinary became the Bedridge House in 1812. In the Civil War, it served as a Confederate hospital during the 1863 Gettysburg Campaign and the headquarters for General J.E.B. Stuart, who hatched battle plans upstairs. Today, visible square nailheads and non-uniform width floorboards appear consistent with 1800s design. In 1937, the property was revamped and expanded to become the Red Fox Inn, a more luxurious property surrounding the original tavern, which became popular with the Kennedys. Jackie Kennedy Onassis frequented the inn during her fox hunting outings. Griswold Inn, Essex, Connecticut. Beneath a dome ceiling made of horsehair and crushed clamshells, the Griswold's Inn Tavern boasts a large and handsome collection of maritime art. In the other rooms, there's an antique firearm collection and a rich history of chaos and gaiety. The tavern room began life as a schoolhouse in 1735, but graduated to become a tavern in 1801, though not before townspeople watched the building roll down Main Street on logs, pulled by a team of oxen to the tavern's current location. Owners maintain that Griswold Inn has been in continuous operation since 1776. Although none of the famed revolutionary rabble-rousers are known to have visited the Griswold Inn, the tavern does have a musket that had in its barrel a note from a father to his son, encouraging Junior to take up arms and join ye ranks of ye Washington. The Griswold Inn was commandeered by the British during the 1814 raid on Essex. A site of temperance movement protests, the banners still hang inside. It is also where Frederick Law Olmsted is rumored to have celebrated his commission to design Central Park. And finally, Pirate's House, Savannah, Georgia. The Pirate's House consists of a number of conjoined historical buildings, including the Herb House, which is considered the oldest standing structure in the state of Georgia. Built in 1734 on the site of the Trustees' Garden, the first public experimental garden in the colonies, where colonists grew cotton and peaches, the Herb House served as the gardener's accommodations. The Pirate's House started operating as a tavern in 1753. Its haint blue shutters and doors ostensibly ward off ghosts. In the mid-1700s, legends tell, pirates began using tunnels under the tavern to kidnap unwary imbibers, including, per one legend, a local constable. Pirate associations continued in the next century. It said Scottish writer Robert Louis Stevenson's visit to the Pirate's House helped inspire his 1883 novel Treasure Island. Pages from an early edition of the novel are on display in the tavern chamber known as the Treasure Room. Next, we'll move on to an article from the prologue section titled Glow Up by Caroline Eubanks. The Switzer brothers created colors so bright they can blind you at high noon. While working a summer job, Bob Switzer, 19, had a nasty fall that left him with a skull fracture and optic nerve damage. Suddenly, the young man had to spend extended periods in darkness to let his eyes recover. Bob's brother Joe, 18, was a chemistry student, and Bob was also something of an amateur photographer. Their father had built them a photo lab in the basement of their family home in Berkeley, California, While Bob recovered in 1933, the brothers passed their time in the darkroom experimenting with different chemicals. One afternoon, they combined rubbing alcohol and murine eye drops, and the result began to mimic fluorescence, a natural phenomenon where some materials absorb light, usually at an ultraviolet wavelength, and transform it into another typically visible light. To enhance the fluorescent effect, the brothers mixed their experimental liquid with a shellac so they could spread it like paint. Under a black light, the duo noticed that the shellacked liquid intensified the colors on the surface of a given object through ultraviolet absorption, which prompted the most dazzling hues. In 1934, the two founded Fluores Art Company, now the Dayglow Color Corporation, to produce and market the pigments. The next year, the brothers figured out how to ditch the black light after they accidentally dropped some silk into a solution of fluorescent dye and alcohol and saw that the fabric glowed even under the sun. These lively paint compounds helped the U.S. in World War II when the military began using the Switzer brothers' pigments to paint aircraft as well as runways on aircraft carriers, giving U.S. planes an advantage when they land during nighttime operations. A 1949 collaboration with Sherwin-Williams made Dayglow paint a fixture on the home front. You've certainly seen the fire orange shade, which remains in use in aviation and safety signage for its high visibility, and safety yellow in those bright triangles that save you from tripping over potholes. The colors entered the counterculture in memorable fashion, as novelist Ken Kesey used Dayglow to create mandala shapes on his famous psychedelic bus, mimicking the trippy visuals conjured by LSD. For all its luridness, Dayglow even entered the worlds of fashion and high art. Jane Fonda wore Dayglow in her popular aerobics videos, while Andy Warhol used the colors to brighten his 1964 flower series. And the colors made Keith Haring's 1982 Untitled an indelible, undeniable sensation. More recently, rapper Kendrick Lamar teamed up with Reebok to produce a Dayglow-inspired line of shoes in 2015. And Dayglow-heavy installations by renowned artists such as Peter Halley continue to be exhibited across the globe. More than 90 years after the Switzers' happy accident, their bold discovery refuses to fade. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian, generously underwritten by the Kepin family. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.